eyes of the world, the eyes of the populations of the world are on you, and we have your numbers.
That lingering sense of fleas remains, and we'll see what comes next.
We need to make sure that what sits there on a piece of paper is actually going to turn into tangible, actionable projects on the ground that are going to make a difference to people's lives.
Hello, you're listening to Bloomberg Westminster, your daily guide to British politics. I'm Caroline Hepke.
Good afternoon, I'm Ewan Potts. So we're back after our festive break to a new year, 2022. The pandemic's still very much with us, but not new COVID restrictions in England, at least.
Well, Boris Johnson has admitted that the NHS will remain under strain for weeks because of the rise in infections. But he insists that there is no data suggesting that further restrictions are necessary in England. That's despite several hospitals now declaring critical incidents and the Royal College of Nursing advocating a, quote, more cautious approach, given the sheer volume of staff absences. Here's the chief executive of NHS providers, Chris Hobson.
We've been very clear all the way along that the government needs to be ready to introduce tighter restrictions at pace should they be needed. And the government, you know, as it said, is looking at that data to decide on a daily basis about whether more restrictions are needed.
So some still advocating for those measures if and when necessary. As for schools, which are beginning to go back today, the government's now advising head teachers to merge classes in preparation for teachers being off sick.
Well, let's bring in our guest today, Conservative MP for North Wiltshire, James Gray. Thanks so much for joining us on the show today. Now, it seems that every time government ministers come out, they're telling us that there won't be more restrictions. The data looks like it's probably going to be OK. We don't need any more restrictions on our lives. But the Prime Minister seems to be terribly cautious, saying there's a lot of pressure on the NHS and we need to be careful. It does feel like there's a bit of a case of mixed messages here.
Not mixed messages, I think, but we're being controlled by the epidemic. These numbers are extremely concerning. I mean, they're very high indeed, and the rate of increase is still very high, although I think perhaps slacking off just a slight bit. But that does mean that even if the virus is less severe than the Delta variant, and nonetheless our hospitals are under huge pressure, just sheer numbers. And that's what we're already seeing with some of these hospitals declaring a state of emergency or whatever it is yesterday and today. So we've got to be very concerned about it. I think we can begin to see the end of it because, as I say, it is much a less severe variant, and that's encouraging. But the sheer numbers are very worrying. Quite that in the last variant, I hardly knew anyone had it. Now I know most of my friends and relations seem to be testing positive.
Yeah, but that's not the message from NHS leaders or from businesses, is it? I mean, it's another pingdemic, although we don't have a catchy phrase for it this time. But it's about massive staff absences. You know, people are having to stay home, restrictions or no restrictions.
I think the staff absences are extremely worrying. That's right. And this has an effect not only in the National Health Service, but also in schools and businesses and elsewhere. It's a bit of a pingdemic, but nonetheless, we've got to take it very, very seriously. It's a very serious disease indeed. It's far, far worse than flu. It's an extremely serious, life-threatening disease. And therefore, we have got to take it seriously. I was in two minds about the Plan B, but eventually I supported the government on it. I'd be look very carefully if the government sought to bring any more changes, any more restrictions, which I personally don't really feel strongly in favour of. But then again, I'm not an epidemiologist, I'm not a scientist, and I really have to listen to what they are advising us to do. And if they tell us to do something and they're serious about it, they know what they're talking about, I'd be one of those who'd be slightly inclined to go along with it.
Do you think the Prime Minister could get new measures passed if he brought them to Parliament?
Well, I think it depends very much on the Labour Party. And the Labour Party at the moment are saying that they would support the government on new measures, or whatever measure might be necessary. There were 101, I think it was, my colleagues who rebelled last time round. And I suspect they would do again, although probably no more than that. But we don't want that. We want to do what's right for the country, what's right for the nation. We don't want Tory MPs rebelling and all that. It shouldn't be party political. We should bring the best thing for the nation as a whole.
But it's deeply party political. I mean, it's even internal party political, surely. Also, the head of the UK's vaccination body, Professor Sir Andrew Pollard, says that it is not sustainable to deliver booster jabs every 6 months, that injections would have to be restricted only to the most vulnerable people, i.e., you know, a big sort of red flag saying that the NHS effectively is cracking under the weight of having to deliver and re-deliver and deliver again vaccine rollouts.
Well, vaccine rollouts have been enormously successful, and no doubt we will have to have vaccines in the future. I'm over 60. And therefore, I've had my flu vaccine every year for several years now. Mm. And I'm sure something similar may well be necessary in the future. But the great thing is that we are developing an immunity. By having this superb rollout of our vaccination program, we are actually developing immunity as a nation, and some people, of course, catching the disease. And that, of course, must be encouraging. Sooner or later, this thing will become an ordinary, everyday part of our life, rather like flu. But we'll never conquer it. We won't beat COVID. COVID is here to stay. We just have to keep it under control.
Do you worry that there's a gulf opening up, not between the Prime Minister and his backbenchers, but between Conservative MPs and public opinion? Public opinion has invariably been in favour of more restrictions and more caution on the virus, and Conservative MPs seem to be generally pushing in the other direction.
I think, by and large, MPs tend to represent their constituencies. Certainly in North Wiltshire, most of my people have been saying, well, we're worried about it, and we want restrictions, we're prepared to live with restrictions. Maybe that's because we're a slightly more prosperous area than elsewhere in Britain. But no, I think the MPs weigh up what their constituents tell them. They weigh up what the science is saying. They weigh up what the politics are and the business and the effects on mental health of further closures and so on and so forth. They weigh all those things up and they come to their own personal conclusion. I came to the conclusion the government were right in bringing in Plan B. A lot of my good friends and colleagues did not. That's a matter for them, but I suspect that probably at the end of the day, we all need to do what's right for the people in our constituencies and for the nation, rather than for any kind of personal view on libertarianism or anything else.
Okay. The other thing that is hitting families is the cost of living crisis. I'll call it that. I've heard it called eat or heat. In your New Year message, you warn of the rising cost of living this spring. Next month, the energy regulator is likely to announce a big jump in the energy price cap that protects householders, of course. What would you like to see the government do to mitigate this?
Well, a great many of us are very concerned about the rising cost of living in general. Inflation itself running about 5%, and that's quite worrying. And as you correctly say, the cost of energy has gone through the roof. It's doubled since this time last year. And everyone's saying it might well go further, because of not least because of the Russians and the Ukrainian crisis and all that. So we've got to keep it under control. We're talking about £1,200 per family increase this year. And families just can't afford that, so we've got to keep it under control. That's why a number of us, I think not including me because I wasn't asked, but a number of us wrote to the Prime Minister this week to say that we want to see two things done, really, with regard to energy prices. The first is, very easy to do it, remove VAT. That's 5% less. The second thing is that one quarter of your energy bill is for green initiatives, and that could be halted temporarily. We could remove them temporarily and bring them back again when the economy is looking better. And those two things alone would go a long way towards relieving the pressure on the families all around the country. Of course, there's a price in that, there's cost in it, and the Treasury may well not be enthusiastic, but nonetheless, I think we do have to be aware of the very real crisis that's facing ordinary families up and down the country.
So you'd like to help on rising energy bills, but plenty of other prices are still going up. Council tax likely to go up this spring. Food prices are going up. Many other things as well. Is this a good time for a hike in national insurance?
Well, I think the national insurance thing is now both passed. Also, not a hike, of course. All we did was we removed the cut in it. You're right. All of these things must be weighed up together. The same thing applies to the removal of the triple lock on the pension. All these things have to be weighed up together. The government have to be aware of the cost to families. They have to be aware of the inflation. And they have to be aware of the increase in energy prices in particular. But we can't do everything. We have to pay for the COVID crisis that we're going through. We have to find a way of doing that. We have to balance the books. And therefore, it's a question of balancing up, weighing up which of these things is the best to do. And for me at the moment, I think energy is one of the biggest issues we're all facing. And therefore, let's try and find some way of doing something about it.
In the face of market forces, of course. On to just one other subject, which I know is very close to you. You supported an amendment to make indefinite leave to remain free for all soldiers, coming from overseas, effectively. Why is that such an important issue to you, this as we kind of debate much tighter restrictions on migration into the UK?
Well, about 5,500 soldiers from the British Commonwealth and elsewhere around the world fighting for Britain. And they served in Afghanistan, Iraq, and in other places around the world. They're absolutely first-class soldiers, many of them, and they're doing just the same job as a British soldier would do. But at the moment, and under government consultations at the moment, if they serve for less than 12 years, They do not get indefinite leave from Maine after the end of their service. They're just sent home. And that seems to me to be terribly unfair. These people are British to all intents and purposes, and they've worked, they fought for Britain in the army. I think they should be given indefinite leave to remain here with their families. Probably a lower figure, perhaps the Royal British Legion suggests it should be after 4 years' service. That seems to me to make good sense. There's also a problem with regard to cash, because at the moment you've got to pay £2,500 per person to get indefinite leave to remain. And one soldier said to me, I've got four kids. That means they want £15,000 from me to remain in the UK. Well, I haven't got it. That's more than my entire annual salary. And so I simply can't do it to the private soldier. So I think the government needs to realise these people are just as much soldiers as anybody else, and therefore find a way of allowing them to remain in the UK at an affordable cost, and after a reasonable length of service. I think 4 years, maybe 6 years, would make good sense.
Very interesting issue. And just finally, just briefly, do you think 2022 is going to be easier for the Prime Minister, easier for Boris Johnson?
We've been through 10 or 15 years of extreme turbulence, what with the Brexit negotiations, the end of Theresa May, three general elections. I very much hope this year will be much, much, much calmer. I want a boring year in politics. I want things to get back to normal. I want a reasonably steady, stable thing. I want to see the end of COVID, the end of Brexit. I want to see the economy under control. And therefore, yes, that would make it a significantly easier year for the Prime Minister and for all of us in politics. I think we need to get back to a nice, quiet, steady way of life.
Well, let's take a look at what else is making news in the world of politics today. Prince Andrew's lawyers will present arguments to a US judge later, asking for a civil case against him to be thrown out. Documents released yesterday show that the woman suing the Duke of York took a payment in order to take no further action against other potential defendants. The prince says that means her lawsuit is barred, but her lawyers say it's irrelevant. Andrew has denied the sexual assault allegations.
Keir Starmer, meanwhile, is attempting to capitalise on Labour's recent poll bounce with a speech in Birmingham today. He has attacked the Conservatives' record in government by drawing attention to GP waiting times and rising taxes. He's also stressing that Labour still has a lot of work to do to gain voters' confidence, and he attempted to strike a patriotic tone at the start of the speech, saying, "I want to celebrate the country we live in."
Well, the government is to extend pardons for more historical criminal convictions related to homosexual activity. Anyone convicted or cautioned for consensual gay activity under now abolished laws can apply to have them disregarded. The Home Secretary, Priti Patel, says she hopes that the revised scheme will go some way to righting the wrongs of the past.
So, some news in the world of politics. Right, let's move on to talk about what's happening with the pandemic in the UK. Joining us now is Oksana Pitsik from the UCL's School of Pharmacy. Oksana, welcome back to the programme. Thank you so much for being with us and Happy New Year. Face masks are now back in secondary schools. Pupils are returning to classrooms from today. Just tell me firstly, what is the evidence that whether they are or aren't working? Because I've actually heard arguments on both sides here.
Well, we do know that there is strong evidence that there is airborne and aerosol transmission, as well as droplet transmission for COVID-19. And because Omicron is so much more transmissible, and with its ability to reinfect those who've already had prior infection more than any other previous variants, there is more case for face masks now than ever because of the nature of Omicron. Surgical masks are not perfect, and certainly alone they're not going to prevent totally break chains of transmission. We know that medical-grade masks like FFP2 do a better job at preventing people from breathing in COVID-19 aerosol. But we see that, for instance, at UCL, we've had our students wearing masks since the start of term back in September without protest and with wide uptake. And that has really helped in terms of preventing local outbreaks, even in the December month. We know that they're not the most comfortable, but it's a small ask to make. But on top of masks, we need to really be talking about air filters. We need more than 7,000 for the 300,000 classrooms that we have. So I think it is time for an Indoor Clean Air Act, just as we demand clean water. We've had all of those changes historically to allow for changes in building structures, et cetera, for health reasons. So that's really the next step. But this is a very reasonable move.
Do we know any more about what Omicron means for children? The reports from South Africa, some of those early reports at the end of last year, that children were getting more sick with Omicron. Have we got any more evidence on that?
So we did see from the South African wave that there were a greater amount of hospitalizations for children under the age of four. But this also could be tied to the fact that so many more people were being infected all at the same time. So while there is more, I would say, evidence and data needed to understand the impact of Omicron specifically in children, we are seeing that younger age groups overall are being infected with this. Now, it may be also more mild because we're seeing that people, those that are older, have vaccinations and other layers of protection, including boosters, which have not been available for younger people. However, I think that in order to prevent long COVID complications in children, it is a priority to ensure that we minimize level of infection amongst children just as much as we prioritize for the rest of the population. And vaccinating children is the obvious next step. We know that based on Canada, the U.S., Israel, there's so much data around the safety of vaccines in this age group that we can, we're really sort of the last in line to take this up for the younger age group.
Yeah, and in the UK, 5 to 11-year-olds who are clinically vulnerable are being offered COVID vaccines, although a weaker formula, as far as I understand it. I mean, what is the case for vaccines for younger children? You say it's very strong. Do you think that the uptake for younger children will be as strong in Britain as it has been for adults?
Well, I think that, again, children live with families and intergenerational settings, and parents are also very concerned about ensuring that their children don't develop other types of complications, because we know that COVID is a multi-system disease. It doesn't just affect the lungs. We know that it also affects the heart and the brain and other organs. So from this perspective, in other countries, there has been very rapid uptake of vaccine for children, including in the U.S. and Canada. So I would say that it's likely that we will follow that trend, even with a late introduction amongst these younger groups.
We were told at the beginning of all of this that the pandemic would end with a less dangerous but highly infectious variant. That sounds like Omicron, doesn't it? Should we be optimistic about that?
Well, the history of respiratory epidemics shows that there are wave-like transmissions with peaks and troughs, and each wave so far has been driven by a different variant of concern. So Omicron, in this instance, has set us back, but we're definitely not at square one due to tools like vaccines and treatments and antivirals that are coming out. For this particular wave, we see it's going to be more like a hairpin shape. So we're going to go up very steeply and then kind of max out and then come down very quickly. This will certainly not be the last variant. We'll see other variants emerge, but by that time, the global population level of vaccine coverage will be higher and we'll be better equipped for it. So we're transitioning into from the acute phase of the pandemic towards endemic state. The WHO is even optimistic that that could happen this summer if the appropriate amount of vaccines are shared with all other countries, including in low-income settings.
Yeah, because if Omicron is highly infectious, obviously it spreads very well. That's, in terms of, you know, for the virus, that's very successful, and it doesn't seem to kill its host as much as the other variants. Could we then go backwards, or is this a sort of a winning formulation for variants, or could a more dangerous one emerge? How does this work?
Well, certainly just because this variant at the moment appears to be less dangerous than Delta based on the preliminary data that we have so far, that doesn't preclude, for instance, a different variant that is more adaptable in other ways. But there is generally a trade-off. Like with SARS, we see it was very much higher mortality rates, and that limited how widespread how many people could infect at the same time. So again, I think this is probably the last winter where we're going to see very critical and difficult decisions to be made around protecting the NHS. I think we'll have in future, again, waves like peaks, but not to the same extent, just due to the fact that the pace of technology and the fact that we're able to hopefully also alongside vaccines get more antivirals that are highly effective in reducing hospitalizations, and rethinking how we are designing our building, having COVID ratings on the standard of ventilation in public spaces. All of these things together mean that we're just going to be in a very different place in the future.
Bloomberg Westminster. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.